Hello, Linux fans, and welcome to another episode of Destination Linux, where we cover Linux news, reviews, and anything else that may be fun or interesting in the Linux world.
And I'm Rocco, and this is episode 14 of Destination Linux. Hi, Rob.
Hello, Rocco. How are you?
Oh, man. What's going on today, brother?
Well, I am battling Wi-Fi issues. So in the last episode, you know, I was talking about Manjaro and it being on the family PC, and everything seems fine.
Right.
But now I'm having these weird issues where sporadically, the Wi-Fi just disconnects.
And, right.
And so I'll type the Wi-Fi security code back in and wait and kind of hold my breath. And sometimes it connects, sometimes it doesn't. And the weird thing is, Rocco, I'll boot in, fresh boot, and it'll pull up fine one time and connect. And then 15 minutes later, disconnect. But then maybe I'll do a reboot the next time and it'll pull in and sit there and just spin and spin and spin trying to connect.
Well, I'll say that, you know, that could be a Manjaro issue, but it could be just a Wi-Fi issue in general, because I've been having not similar Wi-Fi issues, but just Wi-Fi in general. Like when I go to suspend the computer, I will have it to where when I come back, it'll ask for the password again.
Mm.
And I'll put the password in. No matter how many times I put the password in, it will not connect. It'll just sit there and spin and spin. The only way to fix the issue is to reboot the computer.
Oh, bummer.
And I'll tell you what, that's frustrating. when every time you go to suspend, and I could not put it to suspend, but there's certain reasons why I do. And if I got to reboot the computer every time I go to suspend, that may be a problem.
Oh, absolutely. And it's more aggravating than anything. I mean, eventually it'll connect, but, you know, it's one of those things. If you've just got to jump on and pull something out of the cloud to print, for example.
Right.
You know, it could wind up costing you some time. I don't know. I've got to read into the forums. I'll check into everything I can to see. The weird thing is, okay, and I haven't had updates. The weird thing is it's been fine, and it's just like out of the blue this has started happening. So that's where you scratch your head and say, all right, what's going on? You know, is it something I installed? Well, there haven't been any major updates. I haven't had any.
No, maybe, I don't. Maybe I don't need remember to. Having them. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, Intergos is actually pretty good on the updates, but it hasn't had any major Wi-Fi updates or network updates that I know of. So I'm having issues. So it may not just be you, man, on Manjaro.
Maybe. And you haven't had any luck with getting it installed.
No, not as of yet. No.
Okay. Well, we'll keep on you about that, man.
But you know what's great, Rob?
What's that?
The Telegram group. The Telegram group, the people that we have in there, the guys and girls, are pretty much awesome. And they have banter back and forth with each other. But a lot of them will post links to news articles. And a couple of them, and forgive me if I miss any, but Alan and Acid Monkey, they've been posting a lot of different articles on there. And one of the articles that came out of this is Star Citizen. Have you heard of it?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so Star Citizen is a MMO game, which is absolutely huge, and it is a crowdfunded project, and the big news is they are planning on supporting Vulkan only.
Yeah, this is huge.
This is huge news. Now, you know, obviously I don't own Star Citizen, but you can purchase it through a starter pack from the crowdfunding page. And Rob, this says that it is the most funded crowdfunding project ever, with $39 million pledged. That is awesome.
That is, it's phenomenal. And that should get the attention of a lot of game developers to see that, you know, this is going to be focused for Linux and has this kind of backing should be a real eye-opener for developers.
Well, it should get the ball rolling. Let's put it that way. I mean, it will be out-of-the-box support for Linux. And like I said, their intention is... Their intention used to be to support, you know, DX12, but they're going with a Vulkan only because Vulkan can pretty much compare to DX12 and keep up the same pace and still have the open APIs. And, I mean, I looked at this game, and it is just massive. I mean, you can play as a starfighter. You can explore worlds. You can play the FPS shooter part of it. You can get a couple friends together and, you know, jump in a starship and go battle other people. I mean, this game is absolutely amazing, and to see a game of this size, this magnitude, go for Vulkan only and have Linux support, this is what we've been talking about for weeks, about getting companies on the ball with having it support Linux out of the box. This could be it. This could be the start of it.
Now, it's available right now for like the starter purchase or whatever, and they're kind of working on it as you go. Is that right?
Yeah, well, the starter pack gives you access to everything that they have at the moment, with the exception of you can do... Okay, well, let's start out with that. The starter pack gives you everything that they can have. You can play any of the game modules that they have, but it's a continual working process where they're always updating it and adding new things to it. So they're looking at it as like a alpha beta type thing, but you can actually play the game and then give feedback on the game itself. And then if you wanted to support more, you could do add-ons like specific ships that aren't available in the game. And they'll be available in the full game, but right now you could buy them and, you know, actually that would actually support the game more.
Well, I may just have to figure out something there, get a little of that, you know, money that's burning a hole in my pocket. And well, my issue is going to be this. My guess is I'm going to need a fairly substantial system to play this to really get the benefits, because looking at YouTube, this play, the world is massive. The graphics are top notch.
The graphics are top notch, man.
Yeah. There's some scenes of the flyovers over the worlds, over the planets.
Right.
And it's beautiful. I mean, definitely go check that out on YouTube. But also, I imagine that this is going to be fairly graphics heavy, and I haven't read into any minimum specs or anything like that.
Yeah, I was actually trying to look for the minimum specs for it. I guess I should have had that beforehand. But,
but hey, now's my excuse to build a new gaming rig, a new gaming box.
There you go. But it looks like a lot of fun, man.
Well, let's definitely keep our eye on this one. And who knows, maybe we'll see you guys online playing one day. So
yeah.
It'll be fun. Well, there's a little more news, Rocco, related to one of our favorite desktops, which is Mate. So Mate 1.18 has been released. It's gone through 6 months of development. And a lot of what this release about, Rocco, is taking things over to GTK3.
Yep.
And so, you know, that's the next progression with pretty well any GTK-based desktop is kind of migrating over and having everything under 3. There's also updates and added support for mouse and touchpad, improved accessibility support. The Kaja file manager has added some new features. So you've got a copy queue, copy pausing, ask for confirmation before moving files to the trash, support for back forward mouse buttons for directory navigation, and then notification when ejected drives are safe to unplug. And it's nice to see those features added into the Kaja file manager. It definitely needed some
of those features, especially the back and forward mouse buttons. Yeah. I mean, that's what I use a lot of, and it's definitely a good update, I can tell you that.
Yeah, and I think that this will get them, once they're over to GTK3, I think some of the other things, some of the visual side of things, some polish and that kind of thing, will start to come into play and be more of a focus now that they've made that transition over. So,
well, Rob, Solus users will be able to get Mate 1.18 and the Linux kernel 4.9.16, I believe, here.
Nice.
They just announced that they just announced that they are putting it in the Solus repositories. And they also announced that Budgie 10.3 is coming soon. So it should be released in the next week or two.
Yeah, we're going to have to dig into that deeper. That's one I'm kind of really keeping my eye on, because as some of these updates come through, and, you know, there's a lot going on with Solus right now. And as that kind of gets to a stage where it's like ready to jump in with both feet, I'm going to do that.
Yep. Well, Rob, I don't want to go too long on the news because we have an interview with somebody.
Yes, we do.
All right. So we sat down and talked with Joe Resington from the Late Night Linux Show podcast. He also has his own website. He's a musician. And, well, let's get to talking to him.
Yeah, look forward to it. He's a talented guy and been involved in Linux for some time. So look forward to this conversation.
All right, let's do it. Hello, Joe. What's going on, man?
Not too much, man. Not too much. Thanks for having me on the show.
Love having you on the show, brother. So you are with the Late Night Linux podcast.
Yes.
And you've been podcasting for a while. So tell us about it.
Yeah, so I've been listening to podcasts for nearly 10 years now, I think. And I don't know if it says good things or bad things about the podcast that I was listening to, but I always felt like I could do that. You know, you listen to podcasts and you think, yeah, I could have a go at that. And my background's kind of as a musician. And so I've got the audio equipment. That seems to be quite a common theme among podcasters, that they were musicians once upon a time. And so they know about audio and have good microphones and stuff like that. And I tried to get a podcast off the ground with a friend of mine in Germany, but that didn't work out. And then I found a guy who's heavily into Apple stuff. And we bonded over our common ground of hatred of Windows, basically. And so I would always go on about Linux. He'd always gone on about Macs. That was very much not safe for work. We swore like dockers on that show. It was called the Mind Tech Podcast. But he was in LA and I'm in London. And the 8-hour time difference just got the better of us in the end. His circumstances changed and we couldn't find a time to do it. So we had to stop doing that. But in the meantime, I'd also started guest hosting on Mintcast, which is a podcast by the Linux Mint community for all users of Linux, is the tagline on that one.
Right.
And so I was kind of guest hosting that for a while. Then I drifted more into being a regular host of it. And then this is all sort of concurrent. Then I started Linux Luddites with a guy called Paddy. And we ended up doing that for three and a bit years.
Right.
And then Paddy couldn't do that anymore. And in the meantime, Jesse had joined us. And then when that came to its end at the end of 2016, when we knew that was going to happen, and we'd kind of talked about it for a while, and we were hoping to get to 100 episodes, but we got to 94 or something, which is really, really annoying. Because I'd titled the episodes episode 001, like in anticipation of getting to 100, and it was just really annoying. And then Jesse and I were talking, you know, who are we going to get on board, because we didn't want to do the show just the two of us. And we thought that it wasn't really fair to call it Linux Luddites, because I'd started that with Paddy and it was kind of our thing. And we wanted a fresh start, basically. And so the obvious choice to me was Ikey Doherty, because not only is he really knowledgeable about Linux and runs his own distro and is a key part of Intel's internal distro, Clear Linux, so he really knows his stuff. But he also happens to be really funny and entertaining and a good laugh, basically. Yeah, I know you've had him on your show, haven't you? And he's a good crack, as they say in Ireland. And but then I was talking to Jesse about you know, who else could complete the lineup, and we're thinking someone who knows a bit about the Android side of things, and you know, specifically the kind of Google-less Android would be good. And then it just occurred to me, Phelan Whiteley, who we'd met at OggCamp. Odd Camp, which is the t-shirt I'm wearing now. and then we'd had him on the show to talk about how he runs just, well, back then, Signage and Mod, now Lineage, with no Google stuff. And the fact that he also happens to be Irish was just a coincidence, really. And so now we're sort of half UK, half Irish. And it's ended up really that that's the only podcast that I'm doing at the moment, apart from, you know, little guest stuff like this and occasional guest spots on the Ubuntu podcast when they've got no one to, host that, no one to be the fourth host for that.
Joe, I got to ask you if you ever talked with the guys from Linux Outlaws, because that was one of my favorite podcasts for the longest time.
Yeah, well, I met them at Odd Camp in 2012, I think.
Fab and Dan,
yeah.
Dan, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and at Odd Camp, I think it was 12, or might have even been 11. It was the one that was in Farnham, for anyone who can remember. Dan was playing his guitar at this kind of after party. And I had said to him, "Oh, do you mind if I sing a couple of songs?" And so I got up there. I had no idea whether I was going to be any good or not. And so I went on and did a couple of songs. And Fab was really impressed by it, it seems. And so then we kind of hit it off after then. And then I became a kind of friend of the show, as it were. And they played some of my music and everything. And then when Fab moved to London, because the H Online, it was called the H, which was the English version of Heiser. Heiser's the company he now works for. It's sort of like, I don't suppose it has an equivalent really, but kind of like CNET or something like that. It's a huge tech magazine and website in Germany. And it was their English. They tried to do it in London for a while and it didn't work out because everyone used ad blockers, basically, including me. It was a great site. It was a real shame when it shut down. But anyway, when he moved to London, one of the first things I did was go around to his flat and had a drink with him and stuff. So that was good. And you know, we went out a few times, but then just suddenly out of nowhere, he had to move back to Germany, which was unfortunate, but at least he gets to be a bit closer to his wife. But yeah, so I was very, I'm good friends with both of them. And unfortunately, Dan now has had some health issues that's right. Kind of prevented him from doing stuff. And now they're doing Geek News Radio, which is too much about games for my money, I'm afraid.
Oh, okay.
That's the one thing that everyone asks me about games on Linux, and I just have no interest really in games.
Well, those guys were both instrumental in helping me to properly dislike Windows.
Really? I thought Windows does a good enough job of that on its own, doesn't it? A lot of people are forced to use it, but I know very few people who actually like Windows. They might say, "Oh, I have to have it for games," or "I have to have it for work and Exchange servers and stuff like that." But in terms of actual enjoyment of it, I think there are very few people. Most people just put up with it, don't they?
I think the majority of people do, especially if they get a taste of something else and see that, wait a minute, there really are substantial alternatives here. And yeah. Then if you give it time, it's like if I had to go recently and install Windows for someone, step them through the process, and the whole time I'm thinking to myself, this is ridiculous. I mean, when you get used to distro hopping and you can have a brand new fresh OS up and running in 12 minutes or less.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's
exactly.
Like,
if you've got a decent flash drive to install it from, and a decent internet connection and an SSD, you can be installed and updated and have all your applications in under half an hour for most distros.
Yeah.
With Windows, you're looking at hours to days by the time you've done all the Windows updates. I mean, that is one of the key things about Linux for me, is how easy it is to do updates and how transparent that is. Especially if you get comfortable with the command line. I mean, I've been using Ubuntu Zubuntu with XFCE for the longest time. And just with apt-get update, apt-get dist upgrade, you can just see exactly what's happening. What, you know, this is what's going to happen. Do you want to do it or not? Yes. And then you see, if you were so inclined, you could read everything that's happening. Whereas with Windows and with macOS, it's just completely opaque. Sorry, it's just totally opaque. You just have no clue what's happening, how long it's going to take, and all the rest of it. And that's why that's one of the main reasons that I can't stand Windows, really, is the, because security updates to me are such a hugely important factor. I mean, with any software, if you don't stay up to date, then that's where the vulnerabilities come from.
You're right. No, you're exactly right. And I always dreaded clicking on the update button because you don't know if it's going to be 30 minutes. You don't know if it's going to be an hour and 30 minutes.
Well, I was going to say that they have the cute circle that goes around, tells you that it'll be updated in a few minutes.
Yeah. And then having it restart your computer, which I think they're going to stop doing now. But yeah, I mean, the thing is that you can say all these bad things about Windows and it's a very easy target, but the thing about Linux is that we've got so many great platforms, right? We've got, whether you like Ubuntu or Fedora, or if you like something a bit more cutting edge like Arch or Solus, there's the platform, the OS available for anyone, and all the desktop environments. Some people love Unity, some people like LXDE, whatever, KDE, GNOME, whatever. But the problem is, and I think that it's a seriously major problem, is the software that's available. Yeah, there's loads of great open source software, and there's even some proprietary stuff available. But in terms of professionals, I mean, I've heard people talking about more about the move from macOS to Linux and how Apple dropped the ball with these MacBooks, with only having 16 gigs of RAM and stuff like that. But the fact is that without the big software titles, without Pro Tools, without Avid, without Photoshop, After Effects, all of the professional software, Linux on the desktop is not going to take off in the professional space. And for me, that's the only place where the desktop is relevant, really. You've got offices, which I think it is mostly possible to have Linux running there. Munich is what's the word for it? A test case where they did some things wrong. But if all you need is a web browser and an email client, And sometimes not even that if you're using webmail, and be able to do some spreadsheets and stuff like that, then it is feasible to do that within Linux. But if you are a creative professional, then yeah, okay, there's Ardour and there's GIMP and there's stuff like that. But if you are trained and well practiced at Photoshop or Avid or something like that, then there's not a chance that you're going to be able to move over. And so you're stuck in this proprietary OS, be it Windows or macOS. And so, I wish I had some answers. I really wish I had some answers, but I don't. I don't suppose you guys do either.
No, we don't. We talk about it. I mean, that's part of our discussion, is what does it take? And that's one of the things in our discussion, is we feel like Rocco and I kind of agree on this. The more people you have using Linux, GNU Linux, the more people involved there, I think the better, because then you're starting to get hopefully a look at some of the higher end pieces of software that, like you said, primarily artistic people are using, whether it's Adobe products or, go on down the list there. They're not going to look until they see, I think, a larger user base and the potential for, of course, it goes back to the dollar. The potential for added income, follow the money.
But isn't the problem now that we've missed the boat with Linux on the desktop, because the desktop itself is a seriously shrinking market, and it's all about mobile. There's no way that the desktop will go away forever, because you're going to have professionals using it. But you haven't got the home user market to prop up the professional market, or you're getting less and less of that market.
Less of that. Good point. Yeah, that's an excellent point. And you're seeing a dumbing down of just operating systems in general.
Yeah.
You take a look at what Android has done from the tablet, and let's think about how many people out there use their tablet as their primary device, or use their phone, as you said, as their primary device, and do pretty much everything that they would do on a desktop.
Well, yeah, that's a funny question that people ask me. What distro do you run on your main computer? Lineage OS is the answer to that, because my main computer is here. This is my main computer. Having a 5.5 inch screen means that it can be your main computer, basically. And I only really these days turn on the laptop, or I've got a desktop as well, for either, you know, watching media or doing podcasting, really. And sometimes even watching media, I watch on my phone. You know, it's only really if I'm watching stuff with my wife, really, together, watching a movie or whatever. And so I think that I'm not unique, am I, in that my phone is my primary computing device?
Nope.
I'm very normal in that respect. And even though I'm relatively clued up tech-wise and running Linux and stuff on the laptops that I do use and the desktop, I just think that trying to chase this market is a fool's errand, really, because so few people are interested. I mean, I used to have a sideline in fixing computers for people, and I certainly used to be the go-to person whenever any of my friends or friends of friends had a, you know, problems with Windows or whatever. And these days, I see very little of that. Very few people actually bother. I mean, you guys must be in a similar position. You guys are techie enough. You must be the ones that people used to come to, whereas now they've got iPads or Android tablets or phones. And, you know, I hate to be such a doom and gloom merchant, because there, you know, there is still a place for Linux, you know, GNU/Linux on the desktop, and I'm happily using it. But I think that you've got to be realistic in your goals of how many people are going to actually be using it.
You know what? What your statement there, everything you just said, is really accurate, and it's kind of an eye opener for me, because it's easy to get tunnel vision in this stuff. You know? And because we're so focused on what's going on with Linux and the desktop, we're not looking much beyond that. But you're right, and like you, I'm running CyanogenMod because the latest Lineage OS is not working with my Note 3 very well right now.
Well, it's not working with mine. I only just upgraded recently, and I'm not very impressed. It's random reboots and stuff. I'm not very happy, to be honest.
So I'm back on CM13, but you're exactly right. Primarily, day in, day out, if I say which one am I spending the most time with, it's CyanogenMod.
Yeah. Although, ironically, you are probably spending more time with Linux than you were before if you're using a phone, because almost all of the services that you're connecting to are using Linux on the back end. And in terms of servers and cloud and all that, those buzzwords, that is all run by Linux, or almost all run by Linux.
It's all behind the scenes Linux that the average person has no clue that they're using Linux.
Yeah, I mean, billions of people a day probably use Linux without knowing it. Anyone who goes to do a Google search is using Linux.
Yep.
So, Joe, we have, you know, here in America, we have people that really, a lot of people don't care about anything, you know, to do with Linux. all they care about is if they can read their email, if they can, you know, watch Netflix or whatever. So do you find it different in the UK or in other countries that people, it's more accepted with Linux, or it's more known because a lot of the development goes on in other countries?
In my experience, not really. When I speak to Spanish people, they have often heard of Linux. For some reason, it's big down there. I'm not sure why, but it's bigger. But certainly in the UK, it's very uncommon for me to meet someone who knows what Linux is, even, basically. Never mind to have actually knowingly used it. So I get the feeling that it's similar to in the US, really. I'm not sure about the rest of Europe. I mean, I suppose in Germany, it's where I've been, it's similar to the UK. It's as you were talking about, Rob, you've got the tunnel vision, and you think that because we're in this bubble where we all use Linux, you think that everyone else does. But the reality is that, you know, it's funny. I was, where was I? I think I was in a train station or an airport or something, looking around at these thousands of people around me and just thinking, almost every one of these people uses Windows.
Yeah.
And it was just a weird thought to me, but like, if you had never used Linux, you would never even think about that. But yeah, like, these people use Windows and probably hate it. And I just probably don't even know that there's an alternative, because they, you know, even with phones as well, the idea of flashing CyanogenMod or Lineage, it's just totally alien to people. You buy a computer or a device, you know, it's like my washing machine. I wouldn't think to flash new firmware on that, would I? And that's how most people see a computer.
Today, you probably could.
Yeah, you
probably
could.
Yeah.
Right. Or your friend.
Well, I'd like to on my washing machine. It's it flashes random lights at me sometimes. I'd like to put some proper open source software on there.
So I was curious. Are you into Nextcloud and that kind of thing, running your own cloud, and completely free of, say, Google or anything?
No, because Google just works so well. I really should be, and I should hate Google, but Drive works really well, especially doing podcasting with show notes and stuff. Collaborative editing is just so good in Drive that it's just kept me on there. And Gmail is so convenient.
Yep.
I do run a mail server, but in all honesty, it just forwards everything to Gmail because that just deals with it. It deals with all the spam. It has it on every device. And in terms of OwnCloud and Nextcloud, I've tried it out many times for Linux Luddites, but just never, it always felt just half finished to me, really. And I always used to, where are we now? I think we're at 11 or 12 or something. When we were looking at it on Linux Luddites, it was kind of 7, 8, 9. And I always used to joke that it felt more like 0.7, 0.8, 0.9. It just didn't feel finished to me. And I haven't tried it out for a while, but I don't really have the use case for it because I'm just terrible with backups, basically, is the honest truth. I have a desktop with a lot of storage in it. I just chuck everything on that. And anything truly important, I put on some external drives. And it's just a chaotic mess, basically. Like, if you could see the desk in front of me, you'd realize why everything in my life is a chaotic mess, basically. I've got a Raspberry Pi that I have running and stuff, but I've never quite found a good solution for me that's simple and works and is totally risk-free, because I always worry about syncing, that it's a two-way street. And I know, yes, I could use scripts to just push it up one way, but I worry about things that sync, that if something goes wrong the other end and it syncs back down to this end and I've totally lost everything. So that's a very long way of saying no, basically.
Well, I'm curious because more recently I've been reading about setting that up and everything that you need to have in place to make it work effectively. I was checking to make sure that the appropriate apps were available in the Play Store to sync everything. But at the end of the day, what I realized is it's not all there. Not like, and I use G Suite for business.
Right.
And so like you said, the last thing I want to happen is I'm 5 states away and locally at home, something happens, the power goes out or something. Yeah. And now I can't access my stuff.
Yeah.
Can't take that chance. But the idea behind setting up my own and being free from Google even, it's appealing, but at this point in my life, there's just not enough time to get it all worked out and then have the hassles with it. You got to move on to something else. There's always something else, and it's especially when it comes to business, you can't be down,
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, what I would say to that is, I found DigitalOcean to be very, very good. And, for as little as, $5 a month for a basic rig, which is going to be way faster than any sort of Raspberry Pi or anything like that. You've got a server that you've got complete control over. It's as if it's a local box, basically.
Oh, nice.
And so you can install whatever distro. Not quite whatever distro. They've got a lot of them. But, I mean, they've got Ubuntu 16.04, which is what I would use, basically. I think they've even got FreeBSD if you're into that. And so you can just spin up this rig in any of their data centers around the world. They've got a few in the US, I think. And then you can either buy a domain and point it at it or just use the IP address or whatever. And you can have all your Nextcloud and whatever you want running on there. And so that's probably the route I would go, really. I mean, you kind of then, instead of trusting Google, you trust in DigitalOcean with your data.
Right.
But then again, do you trust these professional companies more than you trust yourself? I mean, as you say, if you're out on the road 5 states away, there are so many things that you can worry about with your home connection. I mean, my router, as you would say, often needs to be rebooted. And if I'm not here to physically do that, then I can't access my data for whatever reason, and my internet goes down. Whereas if you've got it in a proper data center like DigitalOcean, I mean, there are other cloud providers. I mean, GoDaddy as well. You know, I was looking through some of my old tweets, and I saw GoDaddy. Well, you know that DigitalOcean are onto something good when GoDaddy are doing a carbon copy of their product. It's the same pricing model and everything, or it was. So, you know, it's not like there's only one option here, but it's something like that. If at least if it's out on the internet somewhere, you've got less control, but you're putting control into the hands of professionals whose job it is to keep that up and running for you.
And that's a huge piece of it, actually. So that's a great thought, actually, because that was kind of the main thing at the end of the day. Is I'm trying to rationalize it. You know, I don't know about you, but mentally I'm going through this process of weighing the pros and cons, trying to figure out, is this worth the time?
Yeah.
Is this worth the effort and the cost that may be incurred, you know, by setting up a separate box and that kind of thing. But that's a terrific solution.
Yeah. I mean, for $5 a year, it's, you know, that's a small price to pay for the freedom. But what I was also going to say is that there's no reason you can't do it at the same time, is there? You can still use Google and stuff, but then you can also be using Nextcloud and testing it out. I mean, it'd be nice to be able to switch to one and just have less complication, but at least for a while to test it out, maybe that's what I would suggest to people.
But the other side of that coin is something you mentioned, because I agree with you on it. Google does such a blasted good job of it.
Yeah.
We use Keep, Rocco and I use Keep for our show notes. And, you know, we share back and forth and it's updated instantly. And I mean, there are so many things, and the way it's tied together, And they're putting more emphasis on that now, especially on the enterprise side, with little bits and pieces tying everything, calendar together with Keep and Drive together with calendar.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, and Gmail as well. Yeah, I get emails for my appointments that I need to do to remind me, stuff like that. It's all so perfectly integrated and all so perfectly evil, isn't it? They've got all of your data.
Yes.
You know. They're storing and mining all of this data. And, you know, I mean, I suppose you could argue that with the business stuff where you're paying a few bucks a month for it, you are buying a product. But certainly for the free stuff, that old adage of if it's free, you're the product. But
right. You're sitting in the airport and you get the pop-up that tells you your flight's going to board within 25 minutes. And then you get another pop-up that says you have time to get Starbucks right around the corner.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's the cost that you pay, isn't it? And you've got to, with everything in life, you've got to have a balance of convenience versus security and privacy and stuff like that. And I don't know, for me, Google, I do get this overwhelming feeling that they are really, really evil, but it's just so convenient for me. And I'm just too lazy. I've got too much. I'm trying to enjoy my life too much to spend all the time trying to replace Google services. And I know people who have done it successfully and running their own mail servers and all the rest of it, but it is such a hassle to do that. I mean, try running your own mail server, even on a DigitalOcean box. I mean, try doing it at home, forget about it. You're going to be blacklisted, you know. But try, even in a data center, you're going to come across problems. We had problems replying to AOL messages, for example. It's a jump through hoops to not have those emails bounce. To be fair, actually, I did have that with Gmail once. I was trying to, for work, I was trying to email someone. And I tried asking about it on Twitter and said, you know, is anyone else experiencing problems with AOL? And everyone was like, what, AOL, what is this, 1997 or whatever? And I was like, well, it's not my fault that my clients use the same email address for 20 odd years, you know.
Right.
So, no. But yeah, trying to run your own mail server anyway, it can be very problematic.
Yeah.
And if you just put your trust in other people, then you've got to decide who you're putting your trust in. And at the moment, I'm fully committed to Google. And I know how foolish that is potentially because of their tendency to shut down products. But the products that I use from Google, I can't see them shutting down.
Right.
Gmail and Drive mostly. I just can't see them shutting those down. It's more the kind of new, if ever they come out with something new, you'd be a fool to jump on with it, basically.
Well, they're trying right now, Joe, to figure out what they want to be in the chat world, be it Allo, be it Hangouts, yep. be it on and on and on. You know, yeah, they've messages. Tried times. Yeah, it's a messenger. Yep.
Yeah. All right. So, staying along those lines, what's your opinion on Vault 7 and all of the CIA stuff, along with Google and vulnerabilities?
I really don't know what to make of it, is the honest answer, because when Snowden first came out with it, with his first set of revelations, it's about the mass surveillance stuff. That confirmed a lot of conspiracy theories. And I love a conspiracy theory. I'm not saying I believe them all, but it's the great yarns, I find. And it seemed to confirm that what we all basically knew was happening. And it just totally normalized that fact, didn't it? That now most normal people have just accepted it as, well, we knew it was happening anyway. Whatever, it doesn't really affect right. me. I've got nothing to hide. Why should I worry? That typical fallacy. And now with these, effectively, the CIA using 0 days to compromise people's machines, be it all of the major platforms as far as WikiLeaks are concerned, that again is something that I had long since suspected. I'd basically known. I mean, it's not news that government agencies buy 0 days from effectively black hat researchers. You know, these researchers find these 0 days and then they're traded as a commodity. And that wasn't news. So I don't see why it was such a huge surprise that the CIA had either found or bought a whole load of these 0 day vulnerabilities and was actively using them against targets. So so on the one hand, it confirms what I already thought was happening. But on the other hand, I really don't know what to make of WikiLeaks and Assange and all that because of the Russian connection. And there are those who say that WikiLeaks is effectively a branch of the KGB. And, you know, without getting too political, I just don't know what to think about it. But from a technical perspective, it's not news to me. It's not a surprise. And those documents are fairly old now, and a lot of the vulnerabilities have been patched. But at the same time, here we are. What about? It was about 3-4 years ago, wasn't it, that these documents come from? You know, there's going to be a whole load more vulnerabilities that they've got hold of and are actively using. So even if WikiLeaks, who said they were going to deal with the companies, with Apple and Google and Microsoft, etc., to patch these things, even if they don't do that, does it really matter? Because they're a few years behind anyway. And so the CIA are all, and probably other government agencies, not only in the US but around the world, that are going to constantly have these 0 days. And to me, it goes to a much, much deeper problem. And that the problem is something that we talked about a lot on Luddites and something that Paddy has drummed into my head. And that is the problem of churn, software churn. This idea, this axiom that we have to have constant innovation, constant improvements, constant development on things. And the idea that we can't just get to a stage where things are finished. There is no such thing as finished software. And it's just accepted that there will be software bugs. Whereas if you look at the software that put men on the moon, that didn't have bugs because they made sure it didn't have bugs because they spent years and years and years making sure, going through every single line of code, every single character of code, making sure there were no missed semicolons or square brackets or whatever, you know. Whereas now there's this culture of throw it together as quickly as possible and innovate at the cost of bugs. And there are developers who've spoken to me about this and written into shows I've been on and said that's impossible. But I question this axiom of whether or not there needs to be this constant improvement. And yeah, okay, new hardware comes out. But I mean, that's kind of the same thing. I've got a laptop that's like 3 or 4 years old and it's doing the job for me. Do we really need new hardware? I mean, that's capitalism for you. And right. Again, we could get into politics if you want about it. But I just think that if the world was a bit more zen about things, this constant desire for improvement is what actually leads to vulnerabilities and issues and problems. Whereas if we had more of a zen approach of what we've got now is great, let's make it stable and stuff. But there's no way that's going to happen. I mean, software developers have to justify their jobs, and so they are constantly developing new stuff. It would be very boring for them and for most people if they said, okay, right, take Android, for example. Let's make that good rather than adding more and more new features into it. Let's make it not crash so often. Let's, make it totally 100% secure. Let's audit this code and make sure that there are no 0 days for the CIA to find and or buy. And people say that's impossible, but if people can find the vulnerabilities and sell them, then people making the software could potentially find it and fix it. But instead, they're too busy writing new features and shiny, shiny new stuff, basically.
Well, Joe, I think it's also a product of what's happened, at least here in the U.S., perhaps same thing in the U.K., where we're in a world now where everybody wants something and they want it now. Yep, and they want something new 6 months later and they want it now. And if you get yourself caught up into that, if you're developing a product or you're building a product or you're releasing a piece of software and you get caught up in that, it's got to be new, it's got to be now, it's got to be this, it's got to be that. And you just take a look at the phone manufacturers. You remember back in the days, well, you may be too young for this, but I had one of the original candy bar Nokia phones that you could throw across the street and, bash it up against a brick wall and go pick the thing up and make a call with it. And it was, it lasted.
I do question that. I am old enough, as it happens, to have had one of those old Nokia phones. Well, several of them. And I suppose they were fairly hard wearing, but this meme that the 3310 is indestructible and stuff, I take issue with that. It's just a plastic phone.
But the bigger point being is you didn't see these releases every 6 months to make the news waves. And what are you doing now where we're adding dual cameras? Okay, is that better than what you had with the single camera and why? You know what I'm saying? It's like it's always got to be churning, just as you said. And I think everyone's caught up in that.
And what's driven the phone market's churn is effectively consumer credit, because I don't know about you guys. I bought my phone. It's a OnePlus phone. You can get it on credit, but the standard way to buy a phone is to buy it on credit or on contract, as we call it here. And so people don't even really realize, I think, most of the time that that's what they're actually doing. They pay £50 a month or whatever for service and get a free phone or get a heavily discounted phone. But the reality is they're buying that on what we call hire purchase, where you effectively like leasing a car or a mortgage on a house. It's debt. You're basically becoming indebted to the phone carrier and then paying that back over 2 years. And if we had a situation where people didn't take on that debt, if they just bought phones outright and realized that the new Samsung phone is $800 or the new iPhone is $1,000, I think people would think twice about it, but they don't see it that way. They think about it more as $50 a month or whatever it is, $70 a month. And what that situation leads to new phones being bought all the time. And this idea that a phone is only going to last you 18 months maximum, really, or maybe 20 months, and then you're going to upgrade, and that drives the phone market forward. And that's what they want. They want to sell new hardware. They want to mine all of these heavy metals, which destroys the environment. And then after 2 years, your phone is just thrown away. Well, it's not thrown away straight away. It usually sits in a drawer somewhere for another 10 years and then gets thrown into landfill and pollutes the water table and all of the rest of it that goes with that. And there are initiatives like Fairphone and stuff, but it's so expensive to do that, that it puts most people off.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of phones, I've got a question for you. How would you feel about Plasma 5 Mobile, you know, being able to install an OS for your phone that's running Plasma 5?
I have tried it. I'm a Nexus 5 that was kindly donated to me. And what I like about Plasma Mobile is the honesty. And what I dislike about Ubuntu phone is the dishonesty. Or the ambition. With Plasma Mobile, they make no claims that it is a consumer-ready product. And so that's how I view it. And I think that it's got some good... I mean, it's been a while since I looked at it, to be fair, but when I last looked at it, I thought it had some good ideas and it's got good potential, but it is nowhere near ready. I mean, it is nowhere near ready. It's alpha quality, basically. Whereas Ubuntu phone, again... It's got some good ideas. I like the fact that it's basically a GNU/Linux box. I can SSH into it. I can do whatever I want with it. But it's similar to the problem with Linux on the desktop. There are very few applications, very few native applications available for it. And the web browser is not good enough, in my opinion, to warrant having all these web apps and to actually use web apps all the time. And so, yeah, Plasma for me is it is what they say it is. It's a work in progress. But I think without millions of dollars investment in it, it's never going to catch up with where we are with iOS and Android. And it's a controversial thing here. iOS, I think, is a very, very good operating system. I've only tested it briefly on other people's devices, and I've got a very old iPhone 4 that was my friend thought was dead, but I managed to resurrect. So I've tried it out a little bit, that is a really solid operating system. And to try and compete with that, I mean, I think Android is lagging behind in terms of stability and stuff, in terms of features and customizations and freedom to do what I want with it. That's why I use Android. And price is a factor to some extent, but the fact that I can flash custom ROMs and install whatever I want and have my own custom launcher and all that kind of stuff. And if I wanted to write my own software for it, I could run it on it. That's all the good stuff about Android. And that can be applied to these other mobile operating systems like Plasma Mobile and Ubuntu Phone. But if you look at iOS and then you look at these new upstarts, the gulf is just unbelievable. And if you see the gulf is like this, then I'm holding my hands up for the audio listeners. And if you, as time goes on, as they attempt to catch up, iOS and Android are running away from them. And so that gap is very, very hard to close because you've got so many years now of, just dominance, I suppose, and so many years of development. People might be surprised about me saying such good things about iOS. It's horrible proprietary software, and that's the main reason that I don't want to use it. Android is getting that way in terms of proprietary, Google moving as much as they can over to proprietary blobs within it. Compared to the actual market leaders, the other offerings are basically a joke to most people. If you're an open source enthusiast, then you can try and be forgiving. But in terms of an actual product, they haven't got a chance.
Well, a prime example of that, of why they don't have a chance, is let's take a look at Windows Mobile. With all the money and all of the marketing, everything that Microsoft put into Windows Mobile, and it's still at like 2.3% market share.
Yeah, which is strange, because here comes another surprise for me. From the testing that I have done of other people's devices very briefly, I have found Windows Phone, certainly 8, to be very, very good. It's a very solid platform. It's not buggy. It does the things that it's supposed to do extremely well.
Anybody want coffee?
I've got water, thanks.
I'm glad that's the sound I was hearing there, Rocco.
That's what it was.
Pouring coffee, yeah.
That's what it was.
But you're right. I had a Nokia. Yeah.
Right. And it's the lack of apps, I think, is the main problem there.
Yeah, I had a Nokia with minimal spec hardware. It was the Nokia 530 because I bought it really on a whim because it was so cheap. And
yeah.
I wanted to check out the operating system. And that little thing was fast and fluid, and it had, like you said, it had everything you need. But you're right, the lack of apps and everything.
Yeah, third-party apps is the main problem. And that's what cripples a lot of systems because we're so far down this road of if you make a mobile app now, if you're a mobile developer, then there are only two choices to, you know, off platform, iOS and Android.
Yeah,
but I think part of that has to go back to what you said about the money too. The open source community, they don't have the millions of dollars that Apple has, that, you know, Google has to develop and continue developing the operating system. So I think that's part of it.
We see that all the time though. We see it in Linux where we find this app and we're like, man, this is phenomenal. This tool right here is better than anything I've used on any platform, and it's like crickets to the rest of the world.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the mobile situation, yeah, it's the money. But then Microsoft have proved that, you know, they're not short of a few quid, are they? And they've failed. So that's not really a good enough argument because they're the poster child for mobile failure, aren't they, really?
Yeah.
Well, I just think that's part of it, that's all. Because I think it is
part of it. And if you could work with the big I mean, in this country at least, one of the big mobile apps is WhatsApp, for example, Messenger. I prefer Telegram, but I have to have both because in order to communicate with people for work and stuff like that. And if that, in order to get that ported over, is going to take a lot of money. Someone is going to have to pay for that. And it's either going to be WhatsApp or Facebook who owns it, or it's going to be the company or organization making the mobile platform. And they only have so much money. And Canonical tried to dump a lot of money into Ubuntu phone and now it feels like it's dead. I don't know to what extent it's going to come back with snaps and stuff, but it does feel pretty much dead to me. They just don't have enough money. Shuttleworth has got pretty deep pockets from selling the certificate business years ago, but they're only so deep and he can only plow so much money into it before he has to cut his losses. And it feels to me from the outside, I might be completely wrong, that's pretty much what he has done now, cut his losses with it. And we've seen it with Firefox OS. Tizen and Sailfish are kind of just about clinging to life, but it just seems to be an impenetrable market to me, the mobile market. And I feel like I've just come on your show and had nothing but doom and gloom for you, but it's how I see it. I mean, yeah, you can be glass half full and say that we're making strides and we've got millions of people using Linux and millions of people using open-ish versions of Android, and that is good, but there are billions of people in the world, not millions.
Well, I mean, no. I think it's both. I mean, I think you need perspective. You know, it's great to talk about how Linux is growing and everything, but you still have to have the perspective that what are we at, depending on who you talk to, 4%, 5%? That's like nothing compared to the full numbers.
Generous.
So, I mean, that's
three
nothing.
At best, I would say.
Well, and that's what makes late night Linux cool, because you've got a nice group of educated people who have some real perspective, real world perspective, let's say. You know, you're not on there promoting something. You're on there, you know, talking about it for real.
I mean, that's something that we're always keen to do on Luddites as well as Late Night Linux, that to be realistic, because if you're going to advocate something, you can't just do it blindly. And that's the difference between evangelism and advocacy, I think, that if you just blindly have faith in this thing that it's perfect in every way, then people aren't going to really take you seriously. If you say that it's this amazing thing, then they try it and say, well, no, it's not really, then they're not going to take you seriously. And if you're generally quite down on things and quite negative about things, when something positive comes along, then people will take you much more seriously. I mean, Maru is a great example of that, because you can't have missed the fact that Ubuntu phone is all about convergence, right? So it's about having one device where you use it as a phone and then you plug it into peripherals and you've got a desktop computer. That was always the dream of it.
Oh, yeah.
Maru OS is a ROM that I think is still just available for the Nexus 5. I'm not sure whether it's been ported to other ones, which is just based on AOSP, so just the open source Android. And so you flash it onto the phone and it's just standard Android, basically, without the Google apps. You can flash Google apps if you want. And it's just ostensibly just a normal Android phone. But then you plug in the right cable to it. I can't remember the name of it to make it HDMI. I bought one. It worked for a few months and then just died. And that's why I haven't been able to check it out. It was quite expensive. But anyway, and then you get a Debian desktop with XFCE, which is running containerized within Android, sharing the kernel, but then containerized, I think. And I was able with that to, in Android, shoot a video of myself just saying, this is me doing a quick test of whatever, and then plugged it in, installed OpenShot and GIMP, made some title cards, edited it together, very short videos, standard definition, nothing too fancy, rendered it, uploaded it to YouTube, and then tweeted about it, all from the phone.
Wow.
Which I found really, really impressive. And there's just one guy working on it, or there was. As I say, I'm a bit out of touch because my cable died, and so I don't want to sicken myself by reading too much about what I can't. I could buy another one, but it was really expensive, that cable. I bought it from eBay, so I should have bought it from Amazon. But that's a different story, my hatred of Amazon.
Kind of along the same vein, have you spent any time with Jide's Remix OS?
Have I spent any time? I've got a Remix Mini.
So do I. Well, I had one. I gave it away.
Right. Mine was in a drawer for a while, but I decided to dig it out and have a play with it. My wife's been away, and I thought, well, it's mostly her desktop, and we've only got this one big screen, 27-inch screen, 1080p. And so that's the only screen it works on, because my other monitor is the old 4.3 one. It's quite a nice Dell 19, I think, which is absolutely fine for most things, but the Remix Mini just only works on widescreen displays. So I don't get much chance to play with it. So I thought I'll dig it out and I'll use that for watching iPlayer and stuff like that while she's away. And I think it's got a lot of potential. I mean, I don't like the fact that typical Android OEM, they've abandoned it on Android 5 point whatever. Meanwhile, the x86 version has been updated to 6 and possibly even 7 now. I don't know. So I don't like the fact that they've abandoned it. You do get some security updates for it. And they had to remove the Google apps, and they've bundled some bloatware with it now and stuff. But I think as a principle, what we're talking about is desktop Android, aren't we? It's Android, really? But it has a proper desktop. You've got a taskbar, you've got a start menu, you've got windowed applications, and for that it is good, and it has improved, I think, over the couple of years. How long did you back the Kickstarter?
I did not, but I purchased the first Remix Mini, so the Gen 1 or whatever. I think there's a new Remix Mini out now,
maybe. Yeah, well, that's the they've got one that is more for TVs rather than, because the first one was marketed as a desktop, and I backed the Kickstarter for that.
I almost purchased one of their tablets early.
That was before, wasn't it? Yeah. I don't see how it would work, a desktop on a tablet.
In hindsight, I'm glad I didn't.
Yeah. But I think Android as a desktop, Google are kind of introducing more and more of those features, aren't they? It's creeping in with the windowed applications and stuff, but what we need to solve is how you get applications which are designed for touch to work well in with a mouse, basically. And Android is for the longest time has supported a mouse. If you connect a Bluetooth mouse to your phone, you'll get a cursor and you can point and click at stuff. It's within the individual applications. That's where I have my issues, really, that it's there are certain gestures with touch which don't work with a mouse. They're very awkward with a mouse. Yeah. And it's the whole thing is at the moment a bit of a novelty. But on the Remix Mini, you've now got TV mode, so you could hook up some sort of Bluetooth remote or something to it, and have a, more of a big picture type mode on it.
There's something about it I'm rooting for. I'm rooting for it almost as if they're an underdog or something, because they're almost there in a lot of areas, like with the File Explorer. It works perfectly fine with mouse and keyboard.
Yeah.
And then there are a few apps that work okay in desktop mode. My biggest problem I had with it was with my monitor. It wasn't supporting a proper resolution, and so everything was overly large and fuzzy, and I never could get past that and wasn't willing to invest in trying to make that better. But I just almost, and probably everyone's going to scoff at this, but I would almost like to see a merging of, say, Remix OS with a proper Linux somehow, and pull in access to those Android apps, somehow melting that together. And maybe that falls back to what you were saying earlier, is because desktop, for what you and I, we all know it for, that's losing favor, and people are looking at Chrome OS. People are looking at
what you've described there is a mixture of Linux and Android, and that's Chrome OS, isn't it?
That's Chrome OS somewhat, yeah.
Yeah, now that on the later Chromebooks, not on my old C720, but on any new Chromebooks that you buy, you can run Android apps.
Right.
Although they don't work very well, apparently, but they're certainly pushing it in that direction, that convergence of Chrome OS and Android. But I don't know, Google are kind of famous for having a few different products that do the same job, aren't they? Like with the messaging, that's right. They've got Hangouts and Allo and, you know, all these others. I think there are even a couple more, aren't there? There's is Allo the text one? And what's the video one?
Yeah, there's Allo and, yeah, there's...
Duo,
yes.
Yeah, Duo. Yeah, and Hangouts. Yeah, they like to hedge their bets, I think. I think it's a big enough company that they've got different departments working on things and not necessarily communicating. It's a bit like the Linux ecosystem, why we've got 10 video editors and none of them are very good, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it presents problems for sure.
Yeah, but I'm not sure whether Android is going to go that way or not, whether Android is going to be converged as the in the Ubuntu sense of it, because I'm not sure that people want that. I think that people are happy with the status quo. They're happy with their phones and, to a much lesser extent, tablets. And I'm just not convinced that there's much more than a niche market for desktop Android, really.
Yeah.
But I might be wrong.
No, but for me, it's fun. And we're the people who we want to see it. We want to try it. Hobbyist, yeah, or whatever you want to call us. You know, I think you're always going to have that. You're going to have a percentage of the population that's just curious.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we distro hop just because we want to distro hop, you know, there's nothing there. That's fun.
So. Yeah. Although not on my main machine, I must say.
Right.
No, I can attest to that. Distro hopping is not fun on your main machine. Trust me.
No, I went through a period of that, but then I've managed to acquire donated laptops, basically, when people have upgraded or whatever. And I said, yeah, I'll have that. And so my main test one is a Core 2 Duo Vio, Sony Vio, that I've put an SSD in and stuff. And that is just fair game for anything that I can throw at it. Be it, you know, Windows. If I do any Windows testing, it tends to be on that. Yeah, it's a good feeling to know that if I totally hose it, it doesn't matter, you know.
Right.
I can plug in my other laptop and be talking to you guys, basically.
So we are two KDE guys. You run...
Oh.
What do you run?
I'm XFCE all the way, basically. I've tried out every desktop going, and Plasma... KDE I used to hate. I just used to really... In the KDE 4 days, it was just a nightmare. KDE 5 now, as that has progressed.
We won't fault you for being wrong.
Oh, well, I won't fault you for being wrong. But every time I've tried KDE 5, it seems to get better and better. But it, to me, I just really, really like XFCE because it's no nonsense, especially now they've added the whisker menu. I don't know if you've ever tried that.
Oh, before. Yeah. Love it. Love it.
Yeah, it is definitely a good menu. Ain't no question about that.
And so now you've got that, and you've had that for years now. It's and XFCE, it kind of goes back to that Zen thing I was talking about. The XFCE works, and okay, it's kind of stuck on GTK 2, and that's going to be a potential big issue soon. But for the last 10 years, it hasn't really changed much at all. They've not felt the need to add loads of features to it beyond the whisker menu, which was something that was lacking. But otherwise, it just works fine. Why do I need new shiny stuff in it? I don't really. And Plasma, I think, is good and can be configured to be either way. You can have loads of ridiculous animations and shiny stuff, or you can turn all that stuff off, which is what I do, and make it essentially the same as XFCE. And then at that point, I'm thinking, why not just use what I'm used to, basically.
Right.
But if I can see serious problems for XFCE and GTK 2 and this needing to transition to 3, basically. And at that point, probably Mate is what I would use, which is close enough. But I moved away from GNOME 2 to XFCE in the first place because GNOME 2 was too heavy for me, for my P4 machine that I was running it on. That's why I ended up with XFCE all those years ago. GTK, I don't know if you guys are aware of how the development of how GTK is, but it is a word that I can't say on your show, beginning with cluster, because the way they have their stable, and it's just so confusing. And if you are a developer, Ikey has talked about it with Budgie. They just keep breaking stuff, basically.
Right.
Whereas Qt seems like a more solid base on which to build your environment, basically. And so I can see why Plasma is less prone to breakage.
Well, that's a question that I have is, they have to know that everything breaks when they update this stuff. So what is the thought process in their minds of, I mean, do they not care? Or, I mean, like, what is the thought process there on their end?
I really wish I knew. You should get someone on to talk about it. You should ask them directly, because I honestly don't know what they... I mean, I always say developers going to develop. You know, developers are going to justify their salary. They are going to develop. And if that means breaking things, then that means breaking things, because I can only imagine it. The thought process is something along the lines of, we want to do X, that's going to break Y. Oh, well, we'll break Y and we'll fix it later, you know. And I think that if you are the GTK developers are so concentrating on GNOME shell that anything else that uses GTK, they're not maybe it's unfair to say they don't care, but it's not a priority for them, maybe.
Yeah, well, Ikey, he didn't hold back in, you know, what was going on there and the troubles it's caused him. And if you see a continuation of that, maybe it works itself out, but it's just going to be a painful process.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's why he's moving over to Qt for Budgie, which LXCE now is dead and is, well, not quite dead yet, but it's moribund is the word for it, about to die. And it's moving over to LXQt now. Yeah. And that is slowly developing. So it seems like maybe KDE was the right horse to back in the long term. If you don't like GNOME, using something that uses the underlying technologies of GNOME probably isn't a good idea. And XFCE, I really do worry about this GTK 3 and 4 situation, because they haven't ported it to GTK 3. And I've spoken to Martin Wimpress about how he's been instrumental, and the team for Mate have ported it all over to GTK 3 now, and with this latest release it is pure GTK 3. they're going to have to do the same thing for GTK 4. And I know how much work it was, or he's told me it was a hell of a lot of work to make it work with GTK 3. And that I worry that the XFCE team is too small to do that.
You're talking about you use XFCE because of it being stable and because it doesn't need all the shiny new stuff. So it would take them a huge amount of time, let alone effort, but a huge amount of time to switch it over. And all of that would, there would be bumps in the road where it wouldn't work the way. So they're almost locked into two.
Yeah. And not to mention the moving over to Wayland, which I can't imagine GTK 2 is going to work well with Wayland, basically. Yeah. And that is the way that we are inevitably moving. And so you're going to get a situation where you've got System D and Wayland, and the older distros are going to be stuck. The ones that didn't adopt System D and the ones that are sticking with X eventually are not going to be able to work with modern applications, because as you get further versions of Firefox and all the rest of it, Chromium, you're going to end up in a situation where your only choice really is to use these newer distros on newer hardware as well, which I suppose you just have to accept, really. Because I've heard good things about Wayland, but I've never really properly tested it. But I hear good things about fixing screen tearing and stuff like that. So I eagerly await a time where I can watch full screen videos on YouTube or iPlayer and not have screen tearing. That would be nice. And if it takes Wayland, then...
Maybe, Joe, that LX-Qt is an option for you in the future then.
Potentially, although there's something about Qt which I don't like, and I wish I could put my finger on it. I don't know if it's default theming or what it is, but there's just something about the look of it which I don't like. And I hope that when I am essentially forced down that route, that I will be able to theme it more like GTK desktops that I'm used to.
Yeah,
but I don't know really. It's I like LXDE, and to me LXQt just seems to be taking LXDE and making it worse. You know, worse is the wrong word, but making it bad, I suppose, because I really like LXDE. But as I said, LXDE appears to be moribund, and we'll see if the Raspberry Pi Foundation forks it and makes Pixel an actual thing, rather than just a theme, a late 90s theme, as I like to say.
A late 90s theme, exactly. But the beauty is, on the positive side of things, we've got enough choice out there. So if you're not locked in, it's not like, oh, well, you know, like if you were avid Windows users and along comes Windows 8.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there were things you could do to some extent. And I mean, Windows is a relatively... how can I put this without getting a lot of flames from people? But it's a relatively open platform in as far as you can install whatever you want. So you can download an EXE or build an EXE and install it yourself, or an MSI, or whatever.
Menus. Yeah, start menus. There's a company, I can't think of the company now, but you basically it brought back the start menu. Start menu.
Yeah, well, you're not totally trapped there. But yeah, choice. For Linux, that is what makes it so good. And I'm not stuck with XFCE. I could install any of the distros and get on with things. I'd be far happier to use KDE Neon than I would Windows, put it that way. Or even Unity, you know, full blown Unity Ubuntu. I'd much rather
use
that.
Now you're going too far.
No, but that's the point, isn't it? That I would rather use something that I really don't like than Windows. That's how much I dislike Windows. But at the same time, I don't have to use Unity, do I? I've got all this choice. And I happen to think that Ubuntu as a base distro is the best that I've tried. It's not the lightest. It's not the fastest. It doesn't have all the software. It's not the most up-to-date. But the Ubuntu LTS as a base, to me, plus some PPAs, is the best experience that I've had with Linux. And then on top of that, I like XFCE or maybe LXDE if it's low-end hardware, or Plasma or whatever. But, you know, that's the way I see it. And I'm sure that plenty of people disagree with me, and I'll say, great, whatever is the best for you, use it. If you want Arch, excellent. Good luck to you. Not for me, thanks.
Yep.
Now, that's what we always talk about is whatever works for you, whether it's free software, whether it's paid software, whether it's Windows or whether it's Linux, whatever works for you, that's what you should be using.
Well, yeah, exactly. There's no point trying to demonize people for using proprietary software like the FSF tries to do. If people can have a productive life, a friend of mine uses a Mac to do post-production sound engineering, and he uses Pro Tools, and that's how he earns his living. And I'm not going to demonize him for doing that. If he's happy to use it, and there are plenty of Windows users. I know someone who happily uses Windows and as part of her job, and that's what she makes a living with, and she's happy. So I'm not going to say, oh, you should definitely use Linux and all the rest of it. You've got to just use whatever you want. And as advocates, we've got to say, look, these are the good things about Linux: security, speed, whatever, freedom, and offer that. And if people if people want to hear about it, it's like the classic sort of vegetarian thing. You know, you're going to know someone's a vegetarian within 5 minutes of talking to them. You're going to know someone's a Linux user within 5 minutes of talking to them. You know, if people start complaining about their computer, that's the time to say, well, did you know I use this other thing and it solves the problem X, Y, and Z that you've just told me.
And I haven't had a flash drive in my pocket here that we could.
Yeah, exactly. Rather than like, can we take 5 minutes to talk about Linux? You know, you're never going to convert people that way.
No. Well, I have a question for you, going back to gaming. So you're not a gamer, and that's exactly why I want to ask you this question.
Okay.
One of the latest articles coming out is Star Citizen is a crowdfunded project, and it's going to go Vulkan only. And what is your take? I think that is something that could start the snowball of bigger tech companies, bigger game companies, planning Linux support out of the box, Vulkan support, which will allow more games to come to Linux, which will eventually allow more users to come to Linux. Because that's why I dual boot Windows. I have Windows 10 on another drive, and I have it for one reason, and that's only to game. Because Battlefield 1...
He uses Notepad on Windows. Don't let him lie to you.
Well, Battlefield 1 won't play on Linux. And until it does, I'll have that Windows 10 drive. So what do you think? Does that start the ball rolling?
Hopefully is all I can say. And Steam as well, hopefully, is going to make it work. But until you can get major titles on Linux and running as well as Windows, if not better, then people are not going to use it. That's my cat, Linus, crying. I think he wants me to feed him.
Nice name.
Yeah. Well, we couldn't think of a name for him. And we were going back and forth. I said, right, he's called Linus, and that's it. Right. My wife was like, okay, fair enough.
Well, I asked you because you're not a gamer. And, I want that objective, opinion on, because like I said, I am a gamer, so I'm excited to see something like this come out, but I need an objective opinion on whether or not that, am I overshooting it? Am I overthinking it or overzealous?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I know some gamers, and I've tried to convert them to Linux and said that you've got Steam, and they're not looking for AAA titles, but it just seems that it just comes down to a very basic thing. If the games that you want to play are either not available or don't run as well, then you're not going to use Linux. And so whatever it takes to make it so that they are available and work well, that's got to happen before gaming on Linux becomes serious. And it looked like with Windows 8 and Microsoft moving to this App Store model, that is my understanding, is that is why Valve started down this SteamOS road, basically. But then Windows 10 came out, and that was still relatively free, as I talked about, the freedom to install whatever you want. And they stopped worrying about that, and that's why SteamOS hasn't become, you know, it become the mainstream. It's not what they care about. Yes, you've got a lot more games available for SteamOS and therefore for Linux. And with the Vulkan thing, if the game developers can actually use that, you know, as the underlying technologies for their games, then to run them properly, rather than porting them over to Linux, right, then, you know, that's what you need to happen. And, I'm talking way above my pay grade here because I really know very little about gaming, but if it seems to me that has got to happen, you know, and if it takes a few high profile, games and Kickstarters or whatever to get that ball rolling, then fingers crossed on it basically. But, it's all about the bottom line, isn't it? If it's cheaper to do it the old fashioned way with DirectX and stuff, then they're going to do that.
That's why Vulkan's so exciting, because it allows the developers to make the underlying technology and have it work out of the box with Linux, so you don't have to port it over. So like this crowdfunding project, it says here in this Phoronix article that it's the most crowdfunding project ever with $39 million pledged. That's a lot of money to pledge.
Is it going to be more expensive to do it in the first place with Vulkan? I don't know. I mean, if you've got a team of developers that are used to doing it the old-fashioned way, and then you say, right, you've got this next version of it, GTA 6 or 7 or whatever the next one is. I suppose that's a bad example because it's more console-based, but whatever, you know, a big first-person shooter or something. If all of your team are used to doing it the old-fashioned way, then you're going to either have to retrain them or more likely hire new people to use new technologies. And I suppose it really comes down to the bottom line, doesn't it? If it's not going to cost them any more, then it makes sense, because why not make it easily portable to other platforms like Linux? Sorry, yeah. My cat's running riot now. He's had enough of me.
Well, we're coming up on the half hour anyway, and listen, I could talk with you for another hour easily, because we're all passionate and we're all into, you know, Linux and our whole discussion. So how do people reach out to you? And also, if you don't mind, do you have any insight to the next Late Night Linux podcast? What's coming up there?
We're recording that in 4.5 hours, actually.
This is a warm-up for you then.
Right. Yeah, I'd forgotten that we were doing it when I agreed to do today. Phelan might not be joining us. I'm not sure. I think he might be. Not much news, actually. More discussion coming up on this one. So I don't want to spoil it too much. We might be talking a bit about Google and AMP, you know, accelerated mobile pages, and what that means for publishers. And it's good news for consumers, potentially. Is it good news for publishers? We might talk about that. But the thing with Late Night Linux is that we have a load of stuff in a document, and then we just kind of work our way through it. And if we decide maybe we'd rather talk about that, that's the beauty of editing. We can kind of pause for a second and say, shall we do that or shall we do that? And then I cut that bit out, and it still seems like we didn't do it or whatever. But yes, you want to find me anyway. LateNightLinux.com is the Linux podcast. If you want me, then JoeRess.com has got links to most stuff. I need to update my about page on that, but that's JoeRess.com. And I'm on Twitter as well, Joe Ressington. I always want more Twitter followers. I think I'm up to like 500 now or something.
Well, I got to jump over there. I'm not a big Twitter user. I'll post something every now and then, but yeah, I'll jump over and follow for sure.
Yeah, that's my main social network of choice, really, because it's just so easy. It's so short. You don't have to put too much thought into it. Just the odd little link or odd thought or whatever.
But, what about Google Plus? Are you active on Google Plus?
I am on Google Plus. I lurk it more than post, to be honest. I used to kind of cross post, but I don't do that much, really. I use it mostly just to I kind of comment on other people's status. I don't know what you'd call it on Google Plus, But I tend to not post too much on there. But you can follow me on there or whatever it is. I can never know. It used to be just circles, and now you can follow people. It's Google Plus is a bit of a mystery to me. The way the notifications work as well. So,
it's like it's still finding itself.
Yes.
Yeah. But I think it's going to get to a point where it does find itself, and then Google will shut it down.
Probably.
People keep talking about that, and I can't help but feel that that's why I've not invested too much into it, to be honest, because although Twitter, again, is not profitable, unless someone like Google buys it, that might go away. So
right.
I don't know, be stuck with Facebook.
Time will tell. Oh, my goodness, don't say that.
I know. I am on Facebook, but I don't use it much. But sorry, carry on.
No, but thank you so much for your time, and it's been a pleasure chatting with you, and look forward to the next Late Night Linux podcast. So, and this will make it even more fun now that we've got to chat and everything, so we appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great to kind of meet you guys face-to-face, and good to be on the show.
Keep up the good
definitely,
work.
We'll definitely have to have you back on, Joe.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks.